drop my armor. I said enthusiastically, "Of course." The writer's brother came over. He was 14 years old and very starstruck. He said, "Mr. Myers, I'm your biggest fan. I love Wayne's World. It's my favorite sketch." I said, "Thank you. But you know that I'm your brother's biggest fan. He's a genius. I learn from him every week." I saw the face of the 14-year-old brother brighten with pride for his older brother. The writer, who had been so offensive when I first joined the show, was puzzled at first and then disarmed. I had seen how hard it had been for him to ask me, his quote-unquote enemy, to meet his brother. It was an act of humble generosity for his brother, and ultimately I saw it as a bid for connection, or at the very least, the opportunity to make amends. I hate fighting. Although you can't tell from hockey, Canadians don't like fighting. We'll fight if we have to. I also hate grudges. My dad used to say there was a condition known as Liverpool Alzheimer's, where you forget everything except the grudges. And of course, I was reminded that my father had actual Alzheimer's. And in remembering that, I realized that life is short and sometimes people don't know how to be, myself included. In 1990, Lorne Michaels asked me if I wanted to make a movie, and we both agreed that Wayne's World, the sketch, could be Wayne's World, the movie. I think this is a good time to make a definitive statement. Wayne Campbell is a Canadian character. There, I said it. I mean, who are we kidding? Let's look at the name, Wayne. That is one of the most Canadian names ever, notwithstanding the obvious Wayne Gretzky. Wayne's last name, Campbell. So many Canadians have Scottish last names. Garth is also a Canadian name. Wayne was a Canadian name of my generation and Garth of a previous generation. Wayne plays street hockey and says, "Car," when a car comes, and "Game on," when it's passed. Wayne goes to Stan Mikita's Donuts, which is a thinly veiled reference to Tim Hortons. The cop at Stan Mikita's Donuts is named Officer Koharski, which refers to an incident that happened on Hockey Night in Canada when New Jersey Devils coach Jim Schoenfeld shouted at referee Don Koharski on national TV, "Have another donut, you fat pig." I was determined to inject elements of my Canadian childhood into the movies I was making in the States to prove that my formative years in Canada weren't just a dream. I call them Letters to Canada. Therefore, in a letter to Canada, the officer was named Koharski, and he was at a donut shop. Aurora is Aurora, that's easy. The bar where Wayne meets Cassandra, played by Tia Carrera, is called the Gasworks. The Gasworks was a heavy metal bar on Yonge Street in Toronto. Most notably to myself, the Gasworks was a place that sold Molson Canadian lager in those big quart bottles. Danger! The production designer on Wayne's World was a Canadian named Greg Fonseca. Not only did he know the Gasworks, but he also came up with the idea of putting the one-story-high rotating table hockey player depiction of Stan Mikita on the roof of Stan Mikita's Donuts. In an example of life imitating art, there is a one-story-high rotating table hockey depiction of Wayne Gretzky on top of his restaurant in Toronto. While some of the filmmaking team wanted the theme music under the opening credits to be a current Guns N' Roses song, I wanted it to be a Queen song. The iconically English band Queen was huge when I was growing up in Canada. Even the Mirthmobile, Wayne's car, the second-hand powder blue AMC Pacer, seems somehow Canadian. Again, other members of the filmmaking team wondered why Wayne wouldn't have a cool car. But the most obvious proof that Wayne is a Canadian character is that he speaks with a Canadian accent. He speaks like everybody I knew growing up in Scarborough. Even after Wayne's World, I tried to write, quote-unquote, Letters to Canada into my movies. In Austin Powers, Mindy Sterling's character, Frau Farbissina, Dr. Evil's wife, is a melange of Rosa Klebb, the villain in the 1967 James Bond film From Russia with Love, and Lotta Hitchmanova. Lotta Hitchmanova was the head of the charitable organization known as the Unitarian Service Committee of Canada, or USCC. She has often been called the Mother Teresa of Canada. I came to know her through the low-budget late-night commercials for the USCC, in which she implored Canadians to give generously to the world's poor. She spoke with a Dracula accent. She pronounced Ottawa as Ottawa, and wore a self-made paramilitary uniform. She scared the shit out of me. Was she in the army? Was she in her own army? Why did she talk like a vampire? This inspired me to say of Frau Verbissena that she was in the militant wing of the Salvation Army. Also, Lotta Hitchmanova spoke and dressed like the terrifying Russian confirmed bachelorette Rosa Klebb, whose weapon of choice was a shoe knife. On top of it all, the name of the actress who played Rosa Klebb was Lotta Lenya. Lotta's first name also inspired a Lotta Vagina, the gun mall of Robert Wagner's cycloptic character number 2. It was also an homage to the Bond villainess Pussy Galore. The name Dr. Evil came from a headline from the British tabloid The Sun. My brother Peter had taken a photograph of the headline of The Sun, which read, "Sex Slaves of Dr. Evil." In the scene where Dr. Evil and Scott Evil are in group therapy with Carrie Fisher, the first father and son to share are named Mr. Keon and his son, Dave. Dave Keon, of course, is my favorite Toronto Maple Leaf. In Austin 1, my United Nations Security Council included Canada, with our representative dressed as a Mountie. In Austin 2, a news ticker reads, "Leafs win the Stanley Cup and Toronto voted best city in the world." The song that Heather Graham's character Felicity Shagwell danced to was "American Woman" by Winnipeg's own The Guess Who. At a certain point after I'd lived in the States for a while, a crisis of Canadian identity began to consume me. There was no CBC. People didn't know or care about Canada. I had Canadian friends, but they were few and far between, and we clung to each other unhealthily. But there was a different complication subsuming my Canadian identity. I had become famous. I was a public person. And as I mentioned at the beginning of this book, Canada is not a famous country. It distrusts fame. And nothing about a Canadian childhood teaches you how to circumnavigate the snakes and ladders of a public life. With my newfound celebrity, I was having an out-of-body experience, and what's worse is that I was out of body and out of country. But moreover, when it came to Canada, I was out of touch. And what happened next put me out of commission. Part 3. Love. Chapter 5. Losing Canada. On November 21st, 1991, I was in my apartment in New York City after finishing a read-through at Saturday Night Live. I got a call from my mother in Toronto that my father's Alzheimer's had progressed to the point where parts of his body were shutting down. He wasn't going to make it through the night. My mom said I should wait by the phone for updates. I had written a sketch that had gotten into that week's show with a recurring character named Simon, a little English boy with no mother, the mother being, quote-unquote, with the angels. Simon was a pastiche of every one of my English cousins who had insanely charming English accents, unlike the horrific Canadian accent that had so offended my father's sensibilities. In many ways, I created Simon, the little English boy, to prove to my dad that if I wanted, I could be an English child and please him. So much of my career was about pleasing him, not in a bid for acceptance, because I always had his acceptance, but in a bid to honor him. I put on the Beatles song Across the Universe partly out of homage to my father's Liverpool roots, and partly because that song, to me, is a perfect piece of art. The song makes you feel like you're traveling across the universe. I fell asleep in my chair, only to be awakened by the telephone. The same phone that, over the years, had consistently given me fantastic news about my career and, with equal consistency, had given me horrific news about my father's health. It was my mom. He was gone. I was numb. There are moments in life when you ask yourself, how did I get here? Earlier that summer, I had finished shooting my first movie, Wayne's World. I would say that it was a great disappointment that he died before my first film was released, but in fact, the greater disappointment was that he had gotten sick the second my career had started to take off, and he had seen nothing of my success on Saturday Night Live. The finality that I would never be able to share any of this with him set in. As I sat alone at my desk, the proverbial big chill overcame me. And yet, strangely, I was relieved. Alzheimer's is a horrible disease, and by the end, you just want it over. My mom called back and insisted that I do the show that Saturday, The show must go on, Michael. I then called my best friend Dave McKenzie. He was devastated. He had loved my father, and my dad had loved McKenzie as if he were his own son. I found myself taking care of McKenzie because that guy can go morbid in true Canadian fashion. I called Lauren. He was fantastic, as Lauren always is in these moments. He asked me if I had spoken to my mother, and I relayed to him that my mom wanted me to do the show that Saturday. Lauren agreed. The show must go on, Mike. I flew up to Toronto. It was one of those sunny but freezing Toronto days. I took a cab out to Scarborough to the funeral home. In the cab, I got recognized, and it was very weird to be a famous person in Canada, but it was equally weird to be a famous person at such a personal time. It was very confusing. For all of my life in Canada, especially out in Scarborough, I was just a private citizen, and in some irrational way I thought, don't these people know what just happened? Even on the most basic level, I couldn't understand how people on the street were smiling and going on with their day. When I got to the funeral home, my brothers and Mackenzie were there. We went down to the basement to pick out a casket. I thought to myself, all right, Mackenzie, here we are, picking out my dad's casket in the middle of Scarborough. Surely to God, you can't get more morbid than this. We selected a casket, and the uncomfortable but necessary conversation of casket pricing began. Mackenzie, out of respect, took a walk around the showroom. When the business was concluded, Mackenzie came back, stricken, white as a ghost. I said, Mackenzie, what's wrong? Zombie-like, he pointed to the corner. Baby coffins, eh? In the corner, there were, indeed, small coffins. He said it again. Baby coffins. For kids, eh? I thought, holy crap, Mackenzie. Just when I thought you couldn't get more morbid than picking up my father's casket, you managed to up your morbidity game by feeling it necessary for me to see the baby coffins. Well played, Mackenzie. Well played, Canada. After the funeral, I went to my mom's house. She gave me some of my father's items. His Encyclopedia Britannica ring, his Royal Engineers cap badge, and surprisingly, his Canadian citizenship papers. I had no idea he had become a Canadian citizen. That Saturday on the show, I did the Simon sketch. The sketch about the little English boy in the bath whose mummy is with the angels. My heart was ripped out of my chest. I didn't know whether I was going to be able to finish it. After the sketch, I put on my street clothes and found a quiet part of Studio 8H and cried. A deep cry from across the universe. I was changed. I was heartbroken, demoralized, spiritually rudderless. My dad's death had rocked my world. I had gone up to Canada almost every weekend while I was on Saturday Night Live, just to visit him. And now, the thought of going up to a fatherless Canada became torturous. I knew every square inch of Toronto. If friends said, meet me at Queen and Spadina, and I was at college in McCall, I wouldn't need a map. I wouldn't even need to know what street I was walking on. My feet would just take me there. And on the way, signposts from my life, mental Google pins, would pop up every 20 feet. That's where I met my first girlfriend. That's where I saw Max Webster. And then, after my father's death, it became, there's where my dad took me to Shopsy's Deli to get a corned beef sandwich. And then, there's where my dad used to work. And there's where my dad used to park the car when we went to the C&E. And so on and so on. Several years before my father's death, I bought a cottage north of Toronto. It had many acres of woods, with a spring-fed pond that during the winter froze flat, making a rink of dreams. I made a little changing shelter, strung up some lights, and skated and stick-handled in the delicious quiet that the snow-laden trees had created. This was my Canadian dream. I rarely left the house, opting instead to just take in nature, hiking, making trails. I went to an IGA supermarket in Cobequenque, Ontario. While trying to buy Kraft macaroni and cheese, which we in Canada call Kraft dinner, a stock boy was pricing cans of Puritan Irish stew and stopped abruptly when he recognized me. He dropped his price gun and zombie walked away as if he had seen a ghost. 10 seconds later, I heard over the PA, "Ladies and gentlemen, Canada's own Mike Myers is in aisle 4. I was surrounded by 200 people. The store manager handed me a wireless microphone. My impromptu speech began, "People of IGA, I'm not one for speechifying, but the hospitality you have shown me here in aisle 4 has left an indelible mark on my heart." I posed for a few pictures, not many, as these were the days before cell phone cameras, but in the melee, I never did get my Kraft dinner. Instead, I made a beeline to the car. In the netherworld between the two sets of automatic doors was a bank of coin-operated vending machines. One of the machines was Wayne's World-themed, but it was clear that it was not officially licensed. It seemed foreign. The cardboard insert looked photocopied, and the Wayne's World logo wasn't quite right. Inside the machine, they sold those plastic bubbles, each containing a button with a catchphrase from Wayne's World printed on it. Two of the buttons caught my eye. One said "Squing," which I realized was probably supposed to be "Schwing," and the other one said "Half-blown clinks." Half-blown clinks? Wayne never said "half-blown clinks." I bought them both, of course. When I got to the car, I realized that these buttons were indeed foreign knockoffs, and that "half-blown clinks" was probably "I've blown chunks." It was literally a case of broken telephone, or, as the English call that game, Chinese whispers. It was getting surreal. Another day, when I was at my cottage, I went into Halliburton, a charming Canadian town north of Toronto, famous for McKechnie's Tap and Grill, owned by former Toronto Maple Leaf Walt McKechnie. Outside McKechnie's, a dude came up to me and said, "Mike Myers?" "That's me," I said. "Mike Myers? What are you doing here?" "Oh, I used to come up to Halliburton as a kid." Then he said, "Yeah, but what are you doing here now? You could be anywhere." And then he walked away laughing, the assumption being that, despite my recent success, I was perhaps too dumb to know that there were other places in the world to go, like Paris or Berlin or Thailand. It made me sad. Why not Halliburton? I like Halliburton. I thought of John Candy at the airport. Between my father's death and encounters like this, trips to Canada became more painful, and thus became less frequent until, for many years, I would only come up for Christmas. I was getting busier. Movies, TV shows, books, promotional tours, more promotional tours. Writing, more writing. Writing while on promotional tours. It was a thrilling time, a confusing time, a gratifying time that I am extremely grateful for, but it left very little time to come home. But home was changing. Canada, for me, was a place that I knew intimately from 1963 until 1983, when I moved to England. It was my sanctuary. It's where I had lived as a private person, as an observer. But now, as a public person in Canada, I had become the observed. Not all attention is flattering, and in aggregate, constant attention can quickly turn into scrutiny, and scrutiny is not always fun and not always comfortable. In my youth, I would absorb Canadian life like a sponge, effortlessly, joyfully, unselfconsciously. Then one day, casual observations became political statements. Going to the hockey game became a public appearance instead of just watching the Leafs. Riding the subway, my beloved TTC, was called, by some cynics, an attempt to appear to be a, quote, man of the people, or even less generously, to, quote, get recognized. I can tell you that it was just an attempt to get to my destination, and if there was a secondary motivation for taking the red rocket, it was an attempt to get a deep hit of Canada, a super toke of home, a fix of the familiar. I knew what was happening, but I couldn't stop it. I was losing Canada. And Canada was losing Canada. The Canada I knew was disappearing. Electrohome, the Canadian company that made televisions, the same televisions that I had watched Team Canada beat the Soviet Union on, went out of business. As did Claritone, the Canadian company that made our record player. Lowney's Candies, makers of the Cherry Blossom, were bought by the American company Hershey. Eaton's department store and the catalog business went belly up. The Eaton's catalog was as much part of the Canadian experience as Macy's and the Thanksgiving Day Parade are for America. The landmark Toronto heavy metal bar, The Gasworks, which I paid homage to in Wayne's World, closed in 1993. In 1999, the Leafs moved from Maple Leaf Gardens to the Air Canada Center. I took this hard. Perhaps, in an irrational way, I took it personally. In 2004, the Montreal Expos moved to Washington, D.C., becoming the Washington Nationals. It's as if every last trace of Expo 67 was becoming unpersoned, expunged from the national consciousness. In 2007, the CN Tower was no longer the tallest freestanding structure in the world. It was usurped by the Burj Khalifa in Dubai, without any outrage, disappointment, or attempt to right the wrong. Canada didn't have the fire in its belly to compete with cities like Dubai, as it had in 1973 when the tower was built. Even BlackBerry, that lone Canadian success story, failed to keep up with the competition, and from 2013 to 2014, its number of users worldwide dropped from 85 million to 46 million. My Canada was dying. Al Waxman from King of Kensington died in 2001. So did Ernie Coombs, Mr. Dress-Up. Glenn Cochran from CFTO News passed away in 2012. But wherever he goes in heaven, I'm sure he's never too far from a couple of lovely ladies. In 2007, Sam the Record Man closed its doors. Its founder, Sam Schneiderman, died 5 years later at the age of 92. In 2013, the CBC lost Hockey Night in Canada. There still is a Hockey Night in Canada, and for a few years it will still be on the CBC, but it's not the same. It should just be on the CBC. And as if that weren't bad enough, in 2008, Hockey Night in Canada lost the rights to the Hockey Night in Canada theme song. Come on, people, it's Hockey Night in Canada, for God's sakes. The question of whether Canada would stay together as a contiguous nation was still unresolved, and throughout the 90s, I watched from America as Quebec had endless debates on the separatism issue, causing a drip, drip, drip of national anxiety. Things nearly reached the breaking point in 1995 when Quebec voted to stay in Canada by a margin of 1 percentage point. We could have had a Quebexit. But one part of Canada did actually separate. In 1999, a new territory, one with a primarily Aboriginal population, was created near the Arctic Circle. Its name? None of it. When my brother told me that it was called None of It, I thought he was joking, because it sounded like he was saying that the Inuit didn't want to be part of Canada anymore. None of it. None of what? I said. They're not getting anything? No, the Inuit are getting none of it. I said, for God's sakes, can't they have some of it and we'll call it a day? My brother said, they're getting some of it. None of it. But unlike Abbott and Costello, my brother stopped the conversation and said, oh, you think I'm saying none of it. The new Aboriginal territory is called N-U-N-A-V-U-T, none of it. Who's on First Nations? There were some Canadian cultural success stories. The Canadarm was developed for the American Space Shuttle program. Designed in Canada, the Canadarm was how the space shuttle retrieved satellites. The word Canada was printed along the length of the Canadarm in oversized letters. I'm not going to poo-poo the technological achievements of this engineering marvel. I will leave that to my American friends, who hold me personally accountable for what they deem to be a modest achievement. Personally, the Canadarm and its oversized logo reminded me of my childhood when I would write C-A-N-A-D-A on the side of my Airfix Saturn V model rocket. Even though I wasn't going up to Canada as frequently as I had before my father's death, Canada still dominated my consciousness while I was living in the States. There's no one more Canadian than a Canadian who no longer lives in Canada. While living in Los Angeles, I communed with my Canadianness by playing hockey twice a week. Ironically, I was playing more hockey on ice in Los Angeles than I ever had during my childhood in Canada. I was in Paris when the Leafs got to the Stanley Cup semifinals in 1993. Because of the time difference, I awoke to the tragic news that Wayne Gretzky had knocked the Leafs out of the playoffs. I was the only person in Paris who was crying, not because of how beautiful the City of Lights is, but because this was the closest the Leafs had come to a Stanley Cup since 1967. During the 2002 Winter Olympics at Salt Lake City, I was thrilled that Team Canada had won the gold medal in men's hockey, beating the U.S. 5-2. I watched the game in L.A. with a Canadian writer-director friend of mine, Calgary's own Rob Cohen. When Canada won, we got into a car and drove around Beverly Hills with a Canadian flag streaming out the window, honking the horn incessantly in hopes of sharing the celebration with fellow Canucks. No one honked back. In desperation, we drove to the Roots clothing store in Beverly Hills. Roots is a Canadian company, and we assumed that fellow Canadians would gather there, or at least the employees would share our excitement. Of course, the only people in the Roots store were foreign tourists, and the employees were American. Oh well. While I felt like I had lost Canada, and that Canada might have lost Canada, I was very touched by the fact that I felt like Canada had not lost me. Canada has bestowed upon me many honors. In 1993, I was made the honorary captain of Team Canada's under-21 team. I went to Calgary with Mackenzie, and during halftime, in front of a packed Saddle Dome, the Calgary Flames' home rink, I took penalty shots on Vladislav Tretiak, the famous Soviet goalie from the 1972 Summit Series. It was a dream come true. In fact, that experience prompted me to take power skating lessons, because there's nothing more humiliating than having 19,000 sophisticated Canadian hockey fans watch you ankle skate. Still, it was a great honor, and Mackenzie and I got schnockered on Electric Avenue in Calgary. We met Lanny McDonald's cousin, or so he claimed. In 2001, the Toronto Maple Leafs put a picture of me from a promotional video they had invited me to do on one of their tickets. I got to keep a full set of gear and a complete uniform, including the socks. In 2002, Toronto suffered from an outbreak of SARS. 44 people died. Once the outbreak was contained, the mayor of Toronto asked me if I would appear on The Tonight Show to let people know that Toronto was now safe. I went on and did my best. And for my efforts, a street in Toronto, in Scarborough to be exact, was named after me, Mike Myers Drive. It's true. You can Google it. Toronto also gave me a key to the city. I was so blown away by this honor that I forgot to ask a few quote-unquote key questions, like, now that I have a key to the city, is there a lock to the city that I should know about? If that's the case, is there a deadbolt to the city? Is there a locksmith to the city in case I lose my key to the city? Can I make copies of the key to the city for my buddies to the city? Is there a church key to the city in case I need to open a beer to the city? Is there a key fob to the city? If so, can the key fob to the city be customized to say, this isn't a bald spot, it's a solar panel for a sex machine to the city? That's all my key to the city jokes. In 2003, I got a star on Canada's Walk of Fame. On that trip, the Toronto Transit Commission gave me an official bus driver's uniform, including hat, tie, and tie pin. Cool. In 2004, I was voted number 20 in the CBC's The Greatest Canadian poll. In 2013, the Canadian government issued a Mike Myers stamp. When I told my mom I was getting a stamp, the first thing she asked, in true undercutting Liverpool fashion, was, who else is getting a stamp? Followed by, what denomination is the stamp? As if further inquiry was needed to determine where I fit on the, quote, having a stamp scale, ignoring the fact that having a stamp might be impressive enough on its own. My mother had temporarily lost sight of the great honor Canada was giving me. In politics, Canada was losing sight of its traditions. On September 28, 2000, Pierre Trudeau died. I took his death very hard, and it underscored my fear that perhaps we had gotten even farther away from the promise of the next great nation. During my time out of country, Canada had a series of prime ministers who, to varying degrees, failed to carry the mantle of Trudeau's clarion call of defining Canadian uniqueness and exceptionalism. In many ways, these prime ministers were like the hapless magician who had to perform on the Ed Sullivan Show right after the Beatles had just played. Trudeau's first replacement, Joe Clark, a progressive conservative, was most notable for his nickname, Joe Who. Political cartoonists had collectively agreed that any rendering of Joe Clark must include him wearing idiot mittens. Clark lasted less than a year, only to see Trudeau return for his second and final tenure, during which I moved away from Canada. But as I viewed Canada from England and later from the United States, I watched my country turn away from Trudeau's level playing fieldism under a new Prime Minister, Brian Mulroney, the affable Irish-Canadian progressive conservative. He was Canada's answer to Ronald Reagan, which of course is absurd, as Ronald Reagan was so American that it would have been impossible for Canada to truly have an answer to him. Mulroney, like his antecedent Reagan, made strides to move away from a mixed economy, wherein the government benevolently referees the market to help working people, toward an unregulated, socially Darwinist, laissez-faire economy. There were some positives while I was away. Canada gained its first female prime minister, Kim Campbell. Shortly after, Canada elected Jean Chrétien, who had worked with Trudeau. Chrétien tried to legalize gay marriage in Canada. By June 2005, legislation had been passed in 8 of the 10 provinces and the Yukon Territory. Chrétien also decided that Canada would not join the U.S.-led, quote, coalition of the willing and join the invasion of Iraq. We had gone to Afghanistan, but Iraq felt like an unnecessary war to him. In 2006, Canada lost sight of its progressive traditions when Stephen Harper, of the Conservative Party, was elected Prime Minister. If Mulroney loosened the jar of reversing progressive policies, Harper opened the jar wide and then threw away the lid and then smashed the jar into 1,000 pieces. Also in 2006, Harper claimed, "You won't recognize Canada when I'm done with it." Canada was no longer going to be a place where experiments and progressivism could take place for the benefit of the world. It was like Trudeau had never happened. If Trudeau had turned up the color on the film of Canada to technicolor levels, Harper made it black and white. Harper's tribalistic policies valued purity, when Canada traditionally had valued parity. We had turned into a junior America. America Light. Diet America. Only without the dynamism of the American dream. Harper played to racial stereotypes and fear. He had his fans. He was in power for almost a full decade. He was sensible to the extent that in times of an economic boom, he was fiscally conservative. He was steady. He wasn't going to do anything crazy. But if we had Harperism for 300 years, we would have had peace and order and the cuckoo clock. As a comedian whose work tends to be non-political, I have struggled with taking a public stand on politics. I have always felt that there's an unspoken deal with my audience that I won't bait and switch them. I don't invite the audience into my house on one premise, and then, once they've taken off their shoes and are sitting on my couch, make them read political pamphlets. So I said nothing. At least Canada was safe. I could turn to my American friends and say, "See all that crazy shit that happens in the world? Well, it doesn't happen in Canada. I mean, sure, it can be a little boring at times, but it's safe." But this was all to change. By early 2014, I was a dual Canadian-American citizen living in New York with an American wife, Kelly, I love you, two beautiful American children, and American friends. My brother Paul had become an American citizen living in Berkeley, California. I had sold my cottage north of Toronto, and although I did the occasional shout-out to Canada on talk shows, I really didn't hear anything about Canada except the odd, sad story about the late Rob Ford. And while I'm happy the man is at peace, I never found Rob Ford's shenanigans and his tragic substance abuse at all funny. I'm not one for schadenfreude, anyways. On October 22, 2014, a lunatic from a theocratic death cult who shall go unnamed gunned down a Canadian soldier, Corporal Nathan Cirillo, while he stood guard in front of the National War Memorial in Ottawa. Corporal Cirillo's gun contained no ammunition. Right-wingers have pointed to this as a flaw in Canadian progressivism, of course. They are missing two key points. One, if Corporal Cirillo's weapon had been loaded, the murderer would now have had two weapons. And two, there is tremendous symbolism in having a person guard a war memorial without the need for a loaded weapon. The terrorist ran across the street, into the very heart of Canadian democracy, the Parliament buildings, and a gun battle ensued. That day, the sergeant-at-arms, the person responsible for protecting the Parliament, was a man named Kevin Vickers. At the sound of the first gunfire, he went to his office and retrieved his service weapon. He then engaged the terrorist. He did his job professionally, calmly, valiantly. It was over. Later, it was revealed that there had been another attack 2 days earlier in a parking lot outside a Veterans Affairs office in Quebec. There, another Canadian hero, Warrant Officer Patrice Vincent, had been killed when a terrorist deliberately ran him and another soldier down with a car. Of course, living in the States, I knew nothing of this until after the attack on Parliament Hill. I send my deepest condolences to the families of these heroes, and I send my sincerest gratitude for their service to Canada. For me, and many Canadians, and certainly the families of the servicemen, this was a low point in the history of the country. During October of 2014, I did a lot of soul-searching and, frankly, a lot of crying. Patrice Vincent seemed like a lovely man, and Nathan Cirillo had a son roughly my own son's age. And the thought that his son wouldn't be seeing his dad again, for me, transformed this tragic event from an emotional national news story to something deeply personal. I was shocked, angry, and saddened, not only at the needless death of Corporal Cirillo and Warrant Officer Vincent, but saddened at the loss of the one bragging right about Canada that I had so heavily relied on, that this sort of thing didn't happen in Canada. I believed we would never get a mission statement. We would never know not only who we are, but why we are, and we would slowly drift into a de facto consumerist suburb of the States. It seemed like all hope was lost. But wait. Chapter 6, A Canadian Future. Questions began to emerge. How did this happen? Are the Canadian security forces doing all that they can? Are there more attacks coming? What are we going to do? Will we double down on security? Will we start profiling people and rounding them up based on ethnicity or religion as opposed to strong intelligence? Will we come up with a Canadian version of the Patriot Act? Will Canadian fighter pilots send a disproportionate quote-unquote message by carpet bombing? But there was a more important question, a fundamental question. It was the same fundamental question that Canada has been asking itself over and over again since 1967. Who are we going to be? This question, who are we going to be, seemed to be a riddle that was all but unanswerable as I sat in America in the 1990s and 2000s, looking northward toward home. At that time, I thought, Canada's not even trying to answer it anymore. They've given up. Who are we going to be is a tough question for a country that doesn't even know who it is or why it is. It's a question that seemed impossible to answer for a country born without a mission statement. Would we ever get a mission statement? Would this young, fragile nation that was created by default, an anomaly of unwanted geography and inconsequential history, a country that evidently is depicted on a globe, but for all intents and purposes could be a quote-unquote land sea, with grizzly bears being de facto sea monsters, a, quote, never was insecure country, would that country ever answer the question, why are we? Why are we? Seriously, why bother? As the scrum of international media surrounded Ottawa, the usual Canadian morbid platitudes crowded the airwaves, creating a 60-cycle hum of banality. But wait, one Canadian voice rang out with the same clarity and gravitas of the carillon inside the Peace Tower of the Parliament buildings. This Canadian voice spoke for the nation by saying, "In the days that follow, there will be questions, anger, and perhaps confusion. This is natural, but we cannot let this get the better of us. Losing ourselves to fear and speculation is the intention of those who commit these heinous acts. They mean to shake us. We will remain resolved. They want us to forget ourselves. Instead, we will remember. We will remember who we are. We are a proud democracy, a welcoming and peaceful nation, and a country of open arms and open hearts. We are a nation of fairness, of justice, and of the rule of law. We will not be intimidated into changing that. If anything, these are the values and principles to which we must hold on even tighter. Our dedication to democracy and to the institutions we have built is the foundation of our society, and a continued belief in both will guide us correctly into the future. Staying true to our values in a time of crisis will make us an example to the world. Criminals cannot and will not dictate to us how we act as a nation, how we govern ourselves, or how we treat each other. They cannot and will not dictate our values, and they do not get to decide how we use our shared public spaces. Today, some speak of the loss of innocence in Canada. This is inaccurate. Canada is not and has never been innocent to the threats we face. And we know, as we have always known, that we are not immune. What is true is that we have never let those threats shape us, and we have never bowed to those who mean to undermine our values and our way of life. We have remained Canadians, and this is how we will carry on. We will get answers to how and why this happened. They will be vital in preventing any future attack. And to our friends and fellow citizens in the Muslim community, Canadians know acts such as these committed in the name of Islam are an aberration of your faith. Continued mutual cooperation and respect will help prevent the influence of distorted ideological propaganda posing as religion. We will walk forward together, not apart. In the coming days, we will be inundated with pictures and videos showing what happened today. But there is one in particular we should all remember. The picture in our minds we have of Canadians helping and protecting Canadians. That is who we truly are, and that is who we shall continue to be. The man who spoke those words was the leader of the Liberal Party, Justin Trudeau. He made the statement from Parliament Hill as he emerged from lockdown after the shooting. Canada will be defined by its ideals alone. Fragile, but very beautiful ideals like, "I am my brother's keeper, and no man is an island," and the notion that the strength of a democracy is not how well we agree, but how well we disagree. Cooperation, mutual respect, a level playing field, a culture that values aligning with fellow human beings as opposed to rewarding those that would power over them. Canada is not a normal nation, and thank God. Let the other normal countries be defined by their cuisine, their banjos, their folklore, their entrenched oligarchic orthodoxies, or their handed-down superstitions. Fate and circumstance have conspired to evolve this underdog nation, Canada, into a beacon of progressive ideals for the world. We weren't attacked by a hostile nation that day. We were attacked by a member of a repellent death cult, guided by a set of brutal, fascistic, misogynistic beliefs that are almost the inverse and opposite of our Canadian ideals. It's almost as if this backward, theocratic darkness allowed us to see our Canadian progressive principles in stark contrast. Sometimes the candle needs the dark. Perhaps this terrible tragedy could mark the beginning of a movement toward a Canadian future. Justin Trudeau's father, Pierre Trudeau, had dedicated his life to such a culture, a just society, a Canadian future defined by us, for us. A country that could become the Panglossic peaceable kingdom that Pierre Trudeau had imagined. Canada didn't double down on right-wing security measures. We returned to peace, order, and good government. And in the words of the great English poet Nick Lowe, as sung by another great English poet, Elvis Costello, what's so funny about peace, love, and understanding? Soon after the Parliament Hill shootings of 2014, I went up to Toronto to visit my mom and my brother Peter and his beautiful family. It had been a while since I had been to see the Leafs play, and although they lost, there really is nothing like the good old hockey game. Hockey Night in Canada asked me to say a few words about the events in Ottawa. I wasn't sure I had anything to say, to be honest. It hadn't been my style to wax political in interviews, but the Parliament Hill shootings were different. It was very emotional for me. I concurred with Justin Trudeau that Canada should not change in the face of this tragedy. Yet, I'm a human being, and my country had been attacked. I was angry. I wanted to make the point that no one should ever confuse Canada's civility for weakness. Any adversary would do so at their own peril. I'm reminded of Passchendaele, Dieppe, Juneau, the Scheldt Estuary, Korea, and Afghanistan, just to name a few. We are a peace-loving nation, but when we've been forced to fight, we have historically done so heroically, knowing that we fight for a collection of beautiful ideals, Canadian ideals. The shootings at Parliament Hill changed me. Articles detailing the reactions of various Canadian political figures showed a disturbing and growing normalization of Islamophobia. This struck me as the antithesis of the Canadian ethos. For months prior to the October 19, 2015 election, I was asked repeatedly by both Canadian and American news outlets to comment on the election. I declined each time. But the election race was close, time was running out, and I felt that Canadian ideals were at stake, and that this election would be a defining moment for Canada. As fate would have it, my good friend and fellow Liverpool FC fanatic, John Oliver, was dedicating an episode of his show, HBO's Last Week Tonight, to the Canadian election. John Oliver had been following Stephen Harper's growing xenophobia. This episode of his show would air the day before the election. He called and asked me if I would join him in imploring the Canadian electorate not to vote for Stephen Harper. I agreed. The first line of John Oliver's piece about the Canadian election went as follows. Canada, the country you think about so little. That's it. End of sentence. However, Oliver, in his brilliance, went on to describe, with rapier wit, the state of Canadian politics. Even I didn't know the full extent to which Canada had reversed its progressive policies. As I said, I live in the States. And you never hear any news about Canada when you live in the States. At all. Ever. And so, at 11:30 p.m. on October 18th, literally on the eve of the election, I put on a Mountie suit, got on a snowplow, and John and I urged Canada not to vote for Harper. It made the news in Canada and the United States that I had taken such a definitive stand. I don't know if it made a difference, but either way, I was happy the next day when Justin Trudeau, leader of the Liberal Party and son of my hero, Pierre Elliott Trudeau, was elected. On November 4th, 2015, Justin Trudeau was sworn into office as Canada's 23rd Prime Minister. One of the first things that happened for Prime Minister Trudeau was a phone call from President Barack Obama of the United States of America. There were the usual pleasantries and congratulations, but supposedly, Prime Minister Trudeau declared on that first call that Canada would not take part in the fighting in Syria and Iraq, and that he was recalling the Canadian fighter jets that were participating in the war against ISIS. Audaciously, Trudeau did not want to put Canadian servicemen in harm's way without either a game plan or an exit strategy. There had been a long list of Canadian prime ministers who had sought the approval of American presidents. Being the youngest of three, I recognized in these approval-seeking prime ministers the younger brother who wanted to tag along with the cooler older brother. Where are you guys going, eh? Mom said I could hang out with you guys. Prime Minister Justin Trudeau, it seems, was going to buck that trend. Moreover, shortly after his call with President Obama, Prime Minister Trudeau welcomed 25,000 Syrian refugees to Canada, welcoming them literally with open arms. A Canadian children's choir sang the Syrian anthem on their arrival. I was moved to tears. It was the inverse and opposite of Islamophobia. Trudeau had pledged in his campaign that he would run a budget deficit for his first 3 years in office to ease the effects of the recent austerity measures that were almost exclusively hurting working people. In America, running on a platform of budget deficit would be deemed political suicide, akin to outlawing beer at NASCAR races. In a bold move that would have shocked even his father, Trudeau the younger formed a cabinet that was 50% female. Some found this move to be either cosmetic, arbitrary, or foolhardy. A reporter asked him, "Why do women make up 50% of your cabinet?" Trudeau replied, "Because it's 2015. Just watch him. What the fuddle-duddle." On a personal note, Trudeau recently put forth a bill that would legalize assisted suicide for the terminally ill. Well before my father got Alzheimer's, he made me promise him that I would pull the plug should he ever get a terminal diagnosis involving either prolonged pain or a vegetative state. And in the hellish, torturous, cruel last year of his Alzheimer's-ravaged, quote-unquote, life, if the doctors had given me a button to press that would end his suffering, I would have hit that button faster and harder than any over-caffeinated aunt who thinks she has the right answer on Family Feud. See, I'm morbid too. God bless Justin Trudeau. Talk about perfect legislation for an imperfect world. Equally bold and pragmatic is Trudeau's pending legislation to legalize marijuana. While the big government culture identity program that I've called the Next Great Nation movement of 1967 to 1976 was abandoned, it doesn't mean that it failed completely. One can argue that it created Justin Trudeau. One can look to Hollywood, the world of architecture, and music, and see the fruits of that investment. In many ways, it's like America's space program. While that big government program is now virtually abandoned, even the most cynical amongst us couldn't call NASA a failure. They put a man on the moon, for God's sake. I'm heartened to see that Prime Minister Justin Trudeau has promised to increase funding for the CBC. If we are to believe, like I do, that Canada now finally has a mission statement and the necessary leadership, perhaps Canada is now poised to be the country most likely to succeed in a rapidly changing world. Canada is ready. Canada already has infrastructure, natural resources, the most fresh water of any country, one of the largest fishing banks in the world, nearly limitless amounts of timber, vast oil reserves, hydroelectric power, nuclear power, diamonds, and other precious metals up the wazoo. Geographically, we are next to the economic powerhouse that is America, the markets of Asia, and the emerging economy of Russia. Because of our NATO ties, we have a strong connection to Europe. Climate change may, sadly, devastate much of the world. However, because of our northern geography, Canada may temporarily benefit from global warming. It may give us a second growing season, which is the usual precursor for cultures that have distinctive cuisines. For example, Italy. Also, if we're smart, we will invest in clean technology. Maybe the fact that we never produced a Canadian car will now be a blessing, because perhaps we can make the best electric car. And Canada could do this. The country is very stable. It values civility. It has a harmonious and diverse population. No internal strife. One of the lowest crime rates in the world. One of the highest literacy rates in the world. And is often voted one of the top three places in the world to live. Recently, Canada was ranked by millennials as the number one place in the world to live. We also have universal health care, which may be Canada's greatest gift to the world. Of course, we argue about universal health care in Canada, and the system is not perfect. But the arguments about health care are usually about how best to improve the system, not whether there should be a system. Healthcare's not easy, people. And I'm going to make a big, bold statement. I think a healthcare safety net is exactly what all governments should be providing. In early March 2016, I got a call that I had been invited to the White House for a state dinner honoring Canada's new Prime Minister, Justin Trudeau. This was mind-blowing to me. I was so excited and so honored. It was the first White House state dinner for a Canadian Prime Minister in 20 years. State dinners at the White House are full of pomp and circumstance. They're very formal affairs. The dress is black tie, and strict etiquette is observed. I was afraid I wasn't going to know anybody, but thankfully Lorne Michaels was there, as were my friends Michael J. Fox and Ryan Reynolds and his lovely wife, Blake Lively. Tradition has it that as you enter the White House, you proceed to the receiving line to meet the president and the guest head of state. I was so nervous to meet Justin Trudeau that I was strangely comfortable having a conversation about foreign policy with the person in the line ahead of me, House Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi. She is very nice. It was just about to be my turn to meet President Obama, Mrs. Obama, Prime Minister Trudeau, and Mrs. Gregoire Trudeau. I could tell that Obama really liked Trudeau, and that made me happy. I was heartened to see how incredibly handsome all four of them were. I know it's shallow, but isn't it awesome that our Prime Minister and his wife are hotties? I shook President Obama's hand and moved down the line to Prime Minister Trudeau. Protocol dictates a handshake. However, the Prime Minister gave me a hug and jokingly said, "Mike, thank you so much. You know that thing you did on John Oliver? It got me elected." I laughed and thought, that's a great joke. Of course, it's unlikely that 2 minutes on HBO would change an election. Then I thought, what got him elected was his eloquent speech after the Parliament Hill shootings. Then I thought, wait, he hugged me. My wife Kelly and I took our seats and listened to two of the greatest speeches I've ever heard in my life, delivered by two of the greatest orators I've ever seen live. The speeches were heartfelt and funny. There was genuine love in the room, both between Prime Minister Trudeau and President Obama, and, if I dare say, between Canada and the United States. We really are brothers. It struck me how remarkable it is that we have the longest undefended border in the world. I felt grateful to have grown up in a country that had peace, order, and good government. A country that enabled a child of working-class immigrants to one day attend a state dinner at the White House, honoring his prime minister. I was very proud of Canada that night. I love Canada. Canada is home. When I see Canadians on the street anywhere in the world, I get very happy. I love that the entire interaction often involves people simply saying hello and then telling me the town in Canada that they're from. I'll be on the street and a fellow Canadian will say, "Mike, Kamloops," and that's it. Nothing else has to be said. I love that. I'm so confident in Canada's future. We know ourselves now. I can't wait for my kids, who are American, to be old enough to be proud that their old man comes from that cool country to the north that has tried harder than any other country in the history of the world to get it right. I know they're going to be proud to be American. What great gifts has America given the world? Great music, movies. They put a man on the moon. Canada may not have put a man on the moon, but it's been awfully nice to the man on Earth. And perhaps that will be Canada's greatest legacy. But having said that, wouldn't it be nice if Canada did put a man on the moon? We can do both. Now. Canada, I have known you for 53 years. Without you, I'd be nothing. Happy 150th birthday. I love you, Canada, and I always will.
The End. We hope you have enjoyed this production of Canada by Mike Myers, narrated by the author. Recorded Books offers a wide selection of bestsellers, mysteries, classics, histories, and more. So look for us at your public library or on download sites online. And thank you for being a Recorded Books reader.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.